Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the possibility that Donald Trump is laying the groundwork for withdrawing from the presidential race as his non-existent campaign self-destructs with daily disasters while his poll numbers continue their downward decline. Alan Lichtman, a political historian at American University who has studied both the American right and the presidency, joins us. The author of The Keys to the White House, a surefire way of predicting the next president, a prediction system that has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, will discuss whether Trump's huge but fragile ego could handle an impending defeat and humiliation, and his frequent complaints that the election is rigged against him is the narrative he is creating to justify a future exit or defeat. Then we will speak with another historian of American elections to explore this unprecedented scenario and speak with Sean Wilentz, professor of American history at Princeton University, whose latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. With President Obama calling Trump, quote, unfit to serve as president while trying to shame Republican leaders into repudiating their endorsements, we will look into what could happen if Trump walked off in a huff before the election, or assuming he gets elected between the election and the inauguration, or after the inauguration, if, as is often rumored, he only wants to win the presidency, not do the job of president. Then finally, with a travel warning now issued against Americans traveling to Miami, Florida, where 14 people are now infected with the Zika virus from having been bitten by mosquitoes in America that now carry the virus, we will examine the role of the Republican Congress in creating this avoidable public health crisis. Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases, joins us to discuss his article at the News and Observer, Dawdling Congress Means Dangerous Delay in Zika Fight, and the deliberate sabotaging of an already compromised Zika funding bill by House Republicans who attached riders against contraception and Planned Parenthood, along with pro-Confederate flag measures and a gutting of the Clean Water Act, to kill the bill and blame it on Democrats just before going on vacation until September the 6th, well after the emergency spending on Zika from the Ebola funds will run out. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University, who has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you so much.
And I'd say, Alan, you've got your work cut out for this election in terms of, I don't think, have we ever had a more unpredictable candidate than Donald Trump running for the presidency in the history of the United States?
Well, certainly not in the modern history of the United States. I'm not going to go back to different times, but certainly in the modern history of the country, we've never had a candidate even approaching Donald Trump. One could say with some reliability that any one of 20 things that Donald Trump has said as a presidential candidate would have driven virtually any other candidate out of the race. But Donald Trump seems absolutely immune to whatever comes into his mind, however outrageous, however far from the truth. It seems to make no difference whatsoever. This is the first candidate I've ever seen who seems to have neither compassion nor empathy nor any shame at all. It matters not what you catch him in. It simply rolls off his back.
Well, there are indications, though, and for the longest time, I've mentioned this on the radio to the point where listeners have written in and saying, you know, get off this jag that you're on. You know, I've often suggested that Trump wants to win the presidency but doesn't want to be president. When his son went to negotiate with the governor of Ohio, who they wanted to, because he was hosting the convention, they wanted him to, one, go to the convention, two, to bribe him. They offered him the vice presidency. And they said, and Donald Trump Jr. said, you know, we want you to do the domestic and foreign policy portfolios. And Kasich's people said, well, wait a minute, what is Donald Trump, your father, going to do? And he said, oh, he's going to make America great again. So there's a real sort of doubt about how serious this guy is and how seriously he's taking this whole situation.
Well, here's what I think about that. Yeah. I think Donald Trump does not want the accountability of actually being president. His whole life has been spent avoiding accountability, stiffing people, going bankrupt and walking away from the bankruptcies. He, as president, you can't walk away. As Harry Truman says, you know, you're riding the tiger and you can't get off. And I think that's the last thing in his life, particularly at the age of 70 plus, and he's going to be during a presidency were he to win, the last thing he wants is to have to make decisions for which he is being held accountable. That's why I think he's setting things up to lose and then blame it on someone else. He's already said, which is astonishing, that, you know, the American presidential election is rigged. Even Richard Nixon, you know, when asked to challenge the 1960 results, when some of his allies said, you know, Mayor Daley in Chicago and others had committed fraud, even Richard Nixon wouldn't go there because we have an over 200 years of respecting a peaceful and orderly transition of power. Trump now is threatening to upset that. Why? Because he's setting up a situation where if he loses, he will blame it on someone else, whoever that may be, you know, the DNC or whatever other, you know, ghost he claims is in the machine rigging the election. I think he's also setting himself up, possibly, it's hard to know with Trump because it changes minute to minute, to get out of the debates, because he's also claimed the debates are rigged. And debates are situations that he finds uncomfortable because, unlike his rallies, he can't control the context of the debates. So I do not think he wants actually to govern. He'd love to be president and go out there and, you know, have all the pomp and circumstances and have all the attention. He doesn't want to have to make accountable decisions.
And do you think that, obviously, has a has an overactive ego, but there's also a sort of frailty to his huge ego, shall we say. And I'm wondering whether he, if things go as badly as they go and continue to go on this downward spiral where every day there's a mistake, he doesn't even really have a campaign that anybody can identify as a real campaign. He makes terrible gaffes and there's hideous news coverage every day. Is it possible at a certain point his ego won't allow that kind of humiliation and that he'll find some way to walk off in a huff?
Well, I think you've gone beyond my competence to psychoanalyze
sure.
Donald Trump. You know, who knows? I think you make a good point, you know, that he may become tired of this. But on the other hand, he can't stand not to be the center of attention. And were he to drop out or withdraw, you know, to become the first candidate ever to do that for a major party, he'd be yesterday's thought. You know, he'd be gone. He'd be nothing. He'd be a subject of ridicule. And I think that side of his personality, desire to always be in the spotlight, will override anything else. But who knows with Donald Trump? You know, he's a very, very difficult personality to predict. But I do think, above all, he wants and craves attention. As he said himself, he does not believe any publicity is bad publicity. So if by saying outrageous and offensive things, that obviously even his fellow Republicans find outrageous and offensive, as long as that keeps him in the spotlight, and as long as that keeps the narrative about Trump, he seems perfectly content.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University. And he has studied both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. And his prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. So when you mentioned a little while ago, Alan, that he has sort of, in effect, been laying the groundwork for a possible exit by saying the elections are rigged and that the debates are rigged because he wants to wiggle out of the debates. Let's play a clip from yesterday at a town hall meeting in Columbus, Ohio, where he did talk about the system being rigged. But he also talked about basically saying, you know, I don't have to do this. I can have a good time. I don't have to stand here and shout and scream in front of you people, which I thought was very revealing. Let's go to that clip.
Hillary Clinton, I got a similar number to Hillary Clinton, and she had Bernie, and she had a hard time putting Bernie away. And Bernie, poor Bernie, he looked so upset. He, you know what? He made a mistake. He shouldn't have made a deal. Sometimes he lost. First of all, it was rigged. And I'm afraid the election's going to be rigged, I have to be honest. Because I think my side was rigged. If I didn't win by massive landslides, I mean, think of what we won in New York and Indiana, California, 78%. That's with other people in the race. But think of it. I hear more and more that the election on November 8th, can you believe we're almost there? This started on June 16th of last year. And I said, wow, let's go do it. It takes guts to do this, believe me. And everybody said, no, it takes guts. I could be having a very nice life right now. I don't have to be with you people ranting and raving, right? Could have a very nice life.
So, Alan, that was Trump just yesterday in Columbus, Ohio. What do you think?
It's very, very difficult to say with Trump. You know, there's an old poem that I'm paraphrasing by T.S. Eliot, decisions and revisions that a minute will reverse. You know, this guy reverses himself in the course of a sentence. There is no way to come up with any model for predicting what Donald Trump may do other than the fact that he's not predictable. I'm not sure he's setting himself up for an exit. I think he may be setting himself up for an excuse when he loses, if and when he loses, to say, it's not my fault, the system was rigged against me. And as I said, that's very dangerous. That really threatens the foundations of our democracy, our more than 200-year history of peaceful transitions of power. Another thing that really bothers me in that, you know, he has stirred up some of the most dangerous and disreputable elements in this country, the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, the Ku Klux Klan believe that Donald Trump has given them legitimacy. I fear what might happen if Donald Trump loses and then says the election was stolen from me. You know, is that going to stir up these people to, you know, engage in some kind of a violent or despicable protest? I'm not saying it will, but that danger lurks beneath the surface and really bothers me.
Well, but the first part of it has happened. He said on any number of occasions that the system is rigged. It does feel like he's laying the groundwork for some kind of an excuse. And, you know, it's not much of a stretch to imagine that there's a lot of anger out there in that constituency that he's riled up. I think your point's well taken.
It's very frightening. I also think there's at least a 50-50 chance he won't debate. Whether he... I think it's remote that he's going to drop out, but I think there's at least a 50-50 chance that he won't debate because he hates that uncontrolled context. And he's already said, you know, it's rigged, and then he'll say he'll have something to complain about with no matter who they choose as the moderator. He'll say the moderator is biased against me. And I certainly think he is setting up a situation where he may well become the first major party candidate not to take part in a presidential debate.
Well, he's already blaming the NFL or the debate commission for scheduling it when there are NFL games on.
With astonishing either lies or ignorance. First saying the DNC fixed the debates.
Right.
When the debates are set by the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates, equally balanced by Republicans and Democrats. And the debate was set in 2015, the fall of 2015, long before anyone knew who the nominees were. And he claims to have gotten a letter from the NFL complaining about scheduling debates with NFL games. And the NFL said, there's no such letter. So just in a very compressed statement, he managed to commit several falsehoods or simply show utter ignorance, or maybe a little bit of both.
Right, but he does that every day, and he gets away with it. Oh, my God. And Hillary Clinton gets slammed for stuff that she, some of which she's done, but a lot of which she's never
done. That's right.
It's too surreal.
I think he recently called her the devil.
He did, you know, yesterday. He called
in league with that, you know, crazy Ben Carson, you know, who said she's Lucifer. Now Trump seems to be joining that insanity.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime, Ian. Take care.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studied both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction systems have correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back exploring this unprecedented scenario with another historian of American elections.
Wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sean Wilentz, who's the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and Bob Dylan in America. His latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Wilentz.
Great to be back, Ian.
Well, thank you, Sean. And I must say that what seems to be happening here with the Trump campaign, there's always been an undercurrent of doubt that I've had, and I've expressed it many times on this program, that Donald Trump wants to win the presidency, but he doesn't really want to be president. And I've also felt and expressed this a number of times that he has such a massive ego that if he thinks he's going to lose, he may find a way to get out of it. And the last thing he can handle is public humiliation. And frankly, it looks like from now on, it's just going to get more and more embarrassing and humiliating for him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could. It's been such a crazy year. I mean, there have been ups and downs. You know, if something were to come out about Clinton or something, you know, some terrible disaster, it's the Clinton campaign, then he'd be up again, and, you know, maybe he'd stick around. But certainly this week is looking pretty dismal, isn't it?
Well, it would be unprecedented for a politician who's nominated by a major party to pull out of a race.
Right.
I don't think there are any historical examples. But he gave a clue to this at a rally in Columbus, Ohio yesterday, when, first of all, he appeared to be laying the groundwork by saying that I'm afraid the election is going to be rigged. I have to be honest. And then he repeated that on Fox News, saying, I hope the Republicans are watching closely or it's going to be taken away from us.
Right.
And then I think it was either at that rally in Columbus or at another rally that he did later that day in Pennsylvania, he said, you know, I'm not sure why I'm here. You know, I'm just standing here ranting and raving to you folks. And, you know, I've had a good life and I can have a good life and I can be enjoying myself. And
right.
And you get the feeling now that apparently they reached out to the House and Senate to campaign to help them get out from under this ridiculously unpleasant and despicable comments that he made about the Gold Star mother. And the House and Senate closed the door on him. So I imagine he's feeling like I'm being hung out to dry, and maybe it's time for me to take a walk.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it depends on what the Trump campaign actually is, which has always been something of a mystery to me. I mean, as far as I can see, the Trump campaign consists of Donald Trump in the Trump Tower tweeting, Paul Manafort around, his tie to Ukraine and to Putin. You know, Roger Stone, who's not necessarily in the room, but he's a troublemaker all around. His kids, his wife, and that's it, as far as I can see. I mean, maybe there's a few others, but not much more than that. It's a shell of a campaign. I'm wondering what the you know, if you have a shell, what's really driving all of this? And I wonder what it is. I mean, I've heard all kinds of rumors about TV networks and all the rest of it, but. You know, I can't tell whether it's falling apart or whether it doesn't really exist, to tell you the truth. But you're right about Trump. I mean, Trump's got, you know, he has a massive ego, if nothing else. It may even be a disturbed ego. And, you know, you don't think that he's going to be able to get through a campaign and lose gracefully by any means. He's also, I mean, he's setting up something very nefarious, which is if, by saying that the thing is rigged and so forth, he's not just saying that he might get out. He's saying that if Hillary Clinton wins, she's illegitimate, that she would be an illegitimate president. And this is something that Republicans, you know, they did it to Bill Clinton as well. They tried to do it with Obama over the birther issue. They're always casting doubt on the legitimacy of a Democratic president. They've been doing this since the 90s. But this would be the nastiest of all. And you'd be saying that she only won because of a rigged system and we have to, you know, shut it down and all the rest. Roger Stone, who is an old Nixon guy, who is very close to Trump, has been saying some things. I've been reading them on the internet, but apparently they're in small TV show kind of things. I'm not sure where it is, but he's been saying them, which are really quite disturbing about civil disobedience and an uprising. They're talking about having a revolution if Hillary Clinton wins. And, Trump, by saying that the thing is rigged, is only playing into all of that.
Well, in terms of Hillary Clinton, of course, Trump said that he attacked Bernie Sanders, in fact, for what he believes was capitulating to Hillary Clinton in the Democratic race, saying that he made a deal with the devil and she's the devil.
She's the devil. Yeah. I saw that quote. Well, you know, I think he's, who knows? I mean, he was trying to court the disappointed Sanders supporters for a while. And now he's maybe he's just saying that I'm the real thing, and he's just a flack for Hillary Clinton in the end. You should come support me. I don't know. Maybe that's what his game is.
And again, I'm speaking with Sean Wilentz, who's the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History 1974 to 2008, Bob Dylan in America, and his latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. So let's, as a historian then, Sean, I'm correct in saying that there's no precedent for a candidate for president after the convention, after the nomination, and in the midst of a campaign, just sort of walking off in a huff. What would happen?
You're correct. There's no precedent for that.
Okay.
Correct.
So what would happen if that were to happen?
Well, I mean, look, I don't know what would happen. The Republican Party would have a huge, huge crisis on its hands. I mean, look, the Republican Party runs its own rules. It's its own institution. It is, you know, it has no constitutional reality. It is simply the Republican Party. They have their rules. I doubt that there's anything in the bylaws that covers this contingency. So I think they'd have to be making it up as they went along. Now, there will be some who will say, I would imagine, if Trump were to withdraw, that the logical candidate for president would be his vice presidential nominee. But Mike Pence was not ratified by he was officially ratified by the Republican Party, but only because he was named by Donald Trump. Now, I suppose he could use that, but there's no particular reason why the party would have to stand by that. It would not necessarily be automatic. And I would imagine that if Trump withdrew, among others, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas would be very head up. Now, there's a question as to whether, you know, in the aftermath of Trump losing, withdrawing, whether the chalice would be so poisoned at that point anyway that nobody would want the nomination, and maybe they'd run Pence as a sacrificial lamb. But it would be madness if that happens.
Well, would this mean that they'd have to reconvene a Republican convention, particularly, say, if Cruz and Kasich and others who didn't pull out and they still got some delegates?
I think that's right. And they would have to have a – I would imagine now – I don't know what the Republican Party rules are. But I would imagine they would have to reconvene with someplace with the delegates that were already elected, most of whom were supporting Donald Trump. It would be a lot like what some of the Never Trump people wanted, which is to have a convention where people were not bound to Trump. In this case, they wouldn't be able to vote for Trump. That would be, you know, but pulling one of those off in, you know, what is it now? It's 98 days till the election. That's a pretty tall order in itself, just to get that pulled off. So I don't know what had happened. It would be chaos.
Well, let me ask you another question. As an historian, is there any precedent for a candidate getting elected and then saying, "I don't want the job"? I mean, already, for example, Trump sent his son Donald Jr. as an emissary to try and get Governor Kasich to endorse him because Ohio was hosting the convention.
Right.
And then the emissary said, I mean, Donald Trump Jr. said, you know, Kasich can have both foreign policy and domestic policy. And the Kasich person said, well, what is your father going to do, Donald Trump? The answer was, he's going to make America great again.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like this guy really. And in fact, today, President Obama came out and said Trump was unfit to serve as president.
I saw that.
So let's assume, God forbid, that he actually gets elected. Could he walk away? Is there a precedent for that? And then just sort of saying, here, turning it to Mike Pence, who I believe he can't stand at any rate. Here it is, buddy. It's on your lap. You know.
Well, nothing like that has happened in American history. You know, the closest thing to it would be Nixon resigning. But Nixon resigned kicking and screaming, and he didn't just say, you know, to Gerald Ford, "Here, Jerry, you take it over. I'm out of here." He effectively did that, but only when his political support had collapsed. That's the only president who has left. I mean, Andrew Johnson was impeached, but he stayed in office. Clinton was impeached, but he stayed in office. And the rest have served their terms, except for the ones who died in office. So, yes, there would be nothing like it. Constitutionally, I mean, he could do that. I mean, a president does not, you know, you don't get arrested for resigning as president. You may resign for president in order to avoid getting arrested, and there have been plenty of presidents who have been around, you know, I suppose somewhere in the second and third year, who have thought that they might want to chuck it just because it's such a hard job. But, you know, no one has seriously done that. But constitutionally, he could resign at any time, and then the vice president would take over, so it would be President Pence.
But he'd have to resign after the inauguration, wouldn't he?
He couldn't
resign in the interregnum between winning.
That would be very interesting, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, under the Constitution, because they will not have been sworn in.
Right.
So the question would then be: is Pence the legitimate successor to someone, even if he has not been sworn into office? That would be very interesting. This is just coming to mind, and I don't know.
Well, let's turn to Barack Obama's remarks today, where he said Donald Trump was unfit to serve as president, and then he called out the top Republicans, Ryan and McConnell, asking why they're still endorsing Trump, because they, you know, given that they need to condemn his comments on a near daily basis. Let me actually read exactly what he said. The question, I think, is that they have to ask themselves, if you are repeatedly having to say in very strong terms that what he has said is unacceptable, why are you still endorsing him? What does this say about your party, that this is your standard bearer? There has to be a point at which you say, this is not somebody I can support for president of the United States. That in itself is pretty unprecedented, isn't it?
It's never happened before. I mean, and as the president said today too, I saw the press conference. I mean, he said, "Look, I've had my differences with Republicans, and you know, I thought that John McCain and Mitt Romney were wrong about all kinds of things, and I ran against them and I won, but I never thought that they were unfit to serve in the office. You know, that they could handle the job," as he says. I can't think. I mean, there have been charges. I mean, the political rhetoric, but nothing like this. Nothing where it goes beyond. Historians should never say never, but This is on a different level, I think, and I think Obama actually made that distinction today. It's not just that he would make a bad president. It's just that he shouldn't even be let in the door. He should be nowhere near it. That's pretty heavy. I remember Ronald Reagan in 1988 when Michael Dukakis was running, and there were completely false rumors about him having some sort of mental problem or depression or something. And Reagan, rather nastily, but rather snidely, said that he would not go after an invalid. And he said this at a press conference. And, everybody laughed that off because it was the affable, Ronnie and so forth. It was a very, very nasty thing to have done. It's sort of saying the same thing, but I don't think anybody took it as anything other than a nasty crack. Obama is completely in earnest. He's completely in earnest. As are, many Republicans seem to be saying this as well. I mean, look. I said this during the impeachment in 20 years ago, that history would track down the people who are enabling this unconstitutional impeachment. History is going to track these people down, whether Trump wins or not, for having supported all of this, even though they themselves say that he is a racist, say that, that he is out of line. They're going to look terrible in the history books.
Well, but isn't that already happening in effect with Obama and others calling out McConnell and Ryan to repudiate Trump's remarks, particularly as the screws are turning over this back and forth insult with the Muslim father and the Gulf Star mother?
This is what's going to happen, I think, Ian, from now on, assuming that Trump stays in the race. It's like he's a man caught between two millstones. The millstone, or the Republicans are caught between two millstones. I mean, they can't support him, and yet they can't reject him. They can't reject him in part because they don't want the Republican Party to lose, because it's an important party for the important election for the Republicans to win. Control of the Supreme Court, control of a great deal, is up for grabs here. So they can't bring themselves to say vote for Hillary Clinton, let alone to even say that they don't support their own candidate. But the other millstone is Donald Trump, who's going to be crushing them, and they're going to be crushed from now until November. And the wheels of justice, they grind exceeding small. Well, these people are going to be ground exceeding small.
But assuming that President Obama is pretty astute about political races, which I think he is, because he's won two very handily, I would think, how would it be in the Democrats' interest to encourage Trump to drop out now, to pile on as Obama is doing? Wouldn't it make sense for him to, do it after he got inaugurated and then quit?
I think that they're simply trying to say, they're just being honorable. They're trying to say how outrageous this is. I don't think that anybody has any real belief that having won the nomination that Donald Trump will drop out. I think that they think he will run, and I think what Obama's talking about is, he's really putting the screws to the Republicans, right? I mean, they now have to make a decision, and it's going to be a very difficult decision for them to make, and I think that's where he's aiming it. I don't think he thinks that Trump's going to be, I don't think that Obama wants Trump to drop out. Okay, I just think he wants to make the Republicans own up to what they've done. They are responsible for Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not a symptom. He's a cause. Or the other way around, rather. He's not a cause. He's a symptom. He's a symptom of everything that's gone curdled in the Republican Party over the last 20 years, at least. And I think that Obama is making them own up to all of that, in a way, and saying, look, you're responsible for this. You have to say something about it. I don't think it goes further than that. I don't think he has a big end game about how to win or how not. I think either way, if Trump drops out, I still think it would be terrible for the Republican Party if he drops out, because what happens to all his voters?
Right.
His voters are not going to go for. They're going to be furious. They're not going to vote for Mike Pence or Ted Cruz. So it's a debacle. It's the dissolution of a party.
So it doesn't really, in terms of damage control, it's hard to assess whether if Trump drops out before the election, it's just as much of a catastrophe as it would be if he dropped out after the inauguration.
Well, I think that they could, I suppose this would be their dream, right? that Trump wins the election. Then he drops out either before or after the inauguration, presumably after the inauguration. He drops out right away, and then they still have the Republicans in power, and they still have the right-wing Supreme Court, and that would be the best possible solution, I suppose, for them. Mm-hmm. But trying to game that and trying to figure out how to get to that point depends. You have to deal with the volatile Donald Trump and the volatility of the election, you know, itself. The political mood at the moment is pretty wild. So that would be one solution. And if I was designing something for the Republican Party, I guess that's what I'd do. Trump gets elected, then hands it over to Mike Pence, for 4 years. It would be awful for the country, but it might be the only way that the Republican Party could muddle through all this.
Well, if Hillary Clinton was a stronger candidate, we wouldn't even be having this conversation, would we? I mean,
that's right. That's true. And she's got, she's got her liabilities, starting with, what the FBI director did to her about a month ago, which I thought was outrageous. But that's beside the point. There are difficulties. I think, though, that in the end, the Democrats are more solid, even with a candidate that's not the most, what should we say, she's not charismatic. She's not a candidate like her husband was. But nevertheless, I think the party is stronger, certainly stronger than the Republican Party was. In the end, she won the most votes by a lot of Democrats. The question is to bring in the independents. But I think they're poised to do that. We'll see if they can do it. But I think that the campaign is going to be okay. It could even be very good. I thought the convention, I was at the convention, actually, for all 4 days of it, and I thought it was a good convention overall. I thought that people were pulled together. There were some people from on the Bernie side who were very upset, and they continue to be upset. But I think and some of them will never ever vote for Hillary Clinton because they hate her so much. But I didn't get the impression that was true for the great majority of the Sanders delegates that were there, and let alone the Sanders supporters who were there. And we'll see what happens. But I don't think that Hillary's campaign is going to be what it's going to be. It's not going to be better than it is, but it's not going to be worse than it is. And I think it's been lifted up over the last week or so. That certainly showed in the polls. I mean, she's got a big bounce out of the convention in the polls. Now, polls are polls, but nevertheless, she has shown a side, I think, to the country that Americans who are very skeptical, or at least somewhat skeptical, are going to kindle to and say, well, okay, she's my candidate. I'm going to vote for her. I think you're going to see more of that.
Sure, and let's face it, Sean, she has to be the luckiest politician in history to be running against this train wreck.
As politics, I'd rather be lucky than good.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure as ever. See you
thank
later.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And again, bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Sean Wilentz, who's the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he's taught since 1979. He's a contributing editor at The New Republic, and his books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History 1974 to 2008, Bob Dylan in America, and his latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians, The Hidden History of American Politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the role of the Republican Congress in creating an avoidable public health crisis, with 14 people now affected by the Zika virus from having been bitten by mosquitoes in America that now carry the virus.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Oh, no, no, no mosquitoes. Oh, no, no, no.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases. He was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peaceably demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. And he has written an article at the News and Observer, "Dawdling Congress Means Dangerous Delay in Zika Fight." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be here again.
And we've already seen the results of this dawdling Congress because the Republicans refused to pass a clean Zika bill, which Mitch McConnell was asked about in an interview in Kentucky on television. And he's saying that all bills are at least a little dirty. That's how Congress does things. But what he didn't say is, after the bill was passed in the Senate, it went into the House, where they loaded on a bunch of contraception restrictions and a defunding of Planned Parenthood, a pro-Confederate flag amendment that was slipped in, and defunding of the Clean Water Act. So little wonder the Democrats didn't pass it, but Mitch McConnell didn't mention that. So do you see this as a collective disgrace? Or is this, because the Republicans, of course, are blaming it on the Democrats, or is this an example of partisanship gone wild?
Yeah, this is partisanship gone wild. I mean, they know how to pass clean bills. Mitch McConnell and the House have done clean bills before in order to get them through. So it's much easier to get a clean bill through both the houses of the U.S. Congress and with the signature of the president than it is a dirty bill, because the president just won't sign it. And what they've done, I think, is criminal, because we've already seen the consequences that there are now 12 domestic cases. Domestically transmitted cases of Zika virus in north of Miami. There are a total of 433 pregnant women in a Zika virus registry here in the United States and D.C. There are 1,658 known cases in the United States and D.C. Now, most of them were from international travel, but as we said, 14 cases are now seen in Florida, and we haven't seen the height of the mosquitoes biting everyone.
And that means that what happened was people came to this country, presumably to Miami, and a fairly defined area of Miami, and then a local mosquito bit them. They had the Zika virus in the blood, and now it spread into local mosquitoes in Miami.
That's exactly right. So that's how Zika is transmitted. A mosquito, one of two varieties of mosquitoes that are in South America and the islands, as well as in the United States, continental United States, will bite somebody who has the virus in their bloodstream and then bite another person nearby, and that person then will become infected with Zika.
And my understanding is that the situation in Puerto Rico is completely out of control, that as bad as that is, that we already have infections now spreading in Miami, it's pretty much out of control in Puerto Rico, from my understanding.
Right. So in the U.S. territories, which include Puerto Rico, there's over 4,750 cases now, so three times what we have in the continental U.S., and there are over 422 pregnant women with the Zika virus infection. And as you know, I don't know if your listeners realize that if a woman is infected in the first trimester of birth, then there's a very high rate of the baby being born with abnormal brains. One in seven babies who are exposed during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy will have microcephaly, or the small brains.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Charles van der Horst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. He was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peaceably demonstrating against law he saw as hurting children and the poor. And he has an article at the News and Observer, Dawdling Congress Means Dangerous Delay in Zika Fight. But just in terms of the money that was originally asked for and voted on, the president asked for $1.9 billion. The Senate voted 89 votes in favor of a compromise just before they began their 7-week break, and that was $1.1 billion. So they cut it down. So the Democrats already felt that they compromised. And then the House turns around and loads all of this other stuff, contraception restrictions, going after Planned Parenthood, which is one of their obsessions, protecting the Confederate flag, which is completely mind-boggling in its sort of reactionary nature. They've obviously placating maybe a handful of Southern legislators, and then, of course, defunding the Clean Water Act. So that's obviously too much for the Democrats' stomach. And what's keeping, whatever's being done now to prevent Zika infection spreading is out of the $589 million that the Obama administration has shifted from the Ebola fund to deal with this crisis. But they're going to run out this month, and Congress is not due back into session until September the 6th. So they're going to run out of money before these clowns, if I can be so blunt, come back from their vacation. And how much are they drawing, by the way, in terms of salaries? Well, women in America are being put through the most agonizing situation imaginable. If you're a pregnant woman and you don't know whether your child is going to have microcephaly, that is the worst form of torture you could possibly inflict on a fellow American citizen.
Yes. So this has been the least productive Congress since the 1952. Over 60 years, they've gotten almost nothing passed. I don't think they've even passed a federal budget. So the least productive Congress, each member of Congress, Senator and House of Representatives, earns $175,000 a year, plus a very generous retirement that the federal government adds into, plus their health insurance. And then they also receive a huge budget for staff and their personal travel. So for a senator, our senator, Burr, he gets over $2.5 million a year for travel and staff. So, and he's already a millionaire, estimated wealth of several million. So it's just beyond belief that these folks are not doing their job and allowing this disaster. If one baby is born with microcephaly, I can tell you I'm going to be hanging it around their necks. Senator Burr is running for re-election, and this will be a huge black mark against him. So, and the other thing, it's not just microcephaly. So it's estimated somewhere about a 1 in 1,000 will develop what's called a syndrome called Guillain-Barré, which is an ascending paralysis that both adults and young people can get. It can be temporary, but it's a huge, costly illness if you've ever known someone. They can be ending up being hospitalized for weeks and weeks until they recover, often needing IC intensive care unit care.
But the writing's on the wall, Charles van der Horst. They are going to run out of money. They're using the Ebola money. That's not going to last through the month. And they don't come back till September the 9th. What was it, September the 6th?
Right. And the mosquitoes in North Carolina are going to keep up on biting through November. So it's just totally nuts.
So what's your sense then of what could possibly shame them into action? Is it so important that they need to fly the Confederate flag, that they need to cut funding for the Clean Water Act, that they need to go out to Planned Parenthood and they need to prevent contraception?
Well, one of the things that's interesting that I've seen, at least in North Carolina, that I'm hoping will happen nationally in more states, is that people are beginning to realize that their decisions of, or the lack of decisions by Congress and their Republican controlled legislatures are impacting everybody, not just liberals or poor people. They're impacting everybody. So Zika virus, as I stated, will infect the wealthy person living in a gated community in Cary, North Carolina, or suburban Charlotte, North Carolina, or wealthy Coral Gables in Florida, or Atlanta suburbs, Decatur, et cetera, with, million-dollar mansions. Those people are at risk as well, and they're not unless they live in a bubble, which, of course, no one does. So, there's now, of all things, there's now a travel warning issued by the U.S. Centers of Disease Control for Miami. I'm not talking Liberia for Ebola. I'm talking Miami. It's crazy. This impacts everybody. In North Carolina, it doesn't matter whether you're wealthy or poor. When you destroy the schools, and you send your kids off in August through the end of August to go back to school, and you see, wait, there's no, another 10 students per class in addition for each teacher to deal with, and no teacher's aides. So all these things have an enormous impact on everybody, and more people are realizing the impact of their decisions to vote for Republicans. Certainly, I've seen about House Bill 2 in North Carolina, and you and I have spoken before, the so-called bathroom bill, which has a number of other provisions in it that are also terrible. But with all the businesses pulling out, the NBA All-Star Game, people from public universities in states that are against us not sending their teams to play against Duke or UNC, and not to play basketball this winter, that's having an impact, a dramatic impact on hotels and restaurants, et cetera, in some of these cities. And conservatives are unhappy with it because they don't understand why the legislature got into this business. Because, the old-fashioned conservatives, they were pro-business, and they're also for private personal liberty. And these folks are making anti-business decisions. Imagine what's going to happen to the tourist industry in Miami Beach as long as those mosquitoes are biting. No one's going to go there. So it's a totally nutty decision. What I'm hopeful is that if enough people realize this, business people, conservative people, that the decisions that U.S. Congress is not making and that the state legislatures are not making will have an impact on them, and then they'll vote them out of office this November.
Well, I worry that the fact that even Donald Trump is doing well in the polls, although Hillary Clinton has gone a little bit ahead of him, and she's obviously not a particularly popular candidate, that one just doesn't know whether or not there are enough reasonable, rational, decent people in this country. It's been so, Trump has made it really clear who he is and what he stands for, if anything, except himself and his own enrichment. And the fact that he's even the nominee, the candidate, and he has a following, I don't know how big it is, but I'm beginning to wonder about, and he, of course, is against science and against global warming, and I'm sure, I don't know what his position on Zika is, but you're down there in North Carolina fighting the good fight against that same kind of reactionary politics that Trump has. And so you're in the arena, you've been arrested on these Moral Monday demonstrations. What keeps you going, or do you not have the same kind of fear that I have, which is, are there enough good Americans left to stop this insanity?
Well, I think there are enough good Americans. I think that I was very moved by a number of the speeches at the Democratic National Convention. Dr. Khan, the lawyer, the father of the man, the Gold Star father who spoke, was very moving. I thought there were a number of people who are very active in issues that are near and dear to my heart, and they were speaking out. In North Carolina, there are a large number of people who are upset about this. We're cautiously optimistic about the November election, and we're all working hard. So I'm going to keep on writing editorials. I'm going to keep on raising money. We have a Democratic field worker staying for free in our house through the election. So I think that, and there are a large number of people working on the issue. So I think change will happen.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, the federal courts threw out the voting restrictions in North Carolina, also in Texas, in Kansas, and in Wisconsin. Wisconsin and North Carolina, in particular, being important swing states. Does that give you some hope that the efforts to suppress the vote, which were pretty flagrant, and by the way, these court rulings were quite stinging in their rebukes of these Republicans, legislators in these states. There's just absolutely no question in the minds of the judges that this was pure voter suppression. So do you think this is a good harbinger for the November elections?
Yes, because in North Carolina alone, we felt that it was going to knock out 100,000 voters from minority voters. So I think it's a very good harbinger, and it's very interesting because most people thought with the U.S. Supreme Court decision, which knocked out the pre-approval process out of the Voting Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act had set aside certain counties in the southern states that needed pre-approval before they changed the voting laws at all. That was knocked out, and then these various state legislators immediately imposed the voter restrictions. And what the worry was that the Voting Rights Act still stayed in place, but it required a much higher burden of proof to prove that the states were in the wrong. You actually had to prove intent to deprive people of the right to vote rather than the pre-approval process. So people thought, well, we won't be able to do that. Well, it's very clear that there were all these smoking guns, as we say, all over, namely that the legislatures were deliberately targeting minorities who voted Democratic by closing various polling centers, by setting up these restrictions. In fact, in the North Carolina decision, I don't know if you saw, they quoted from Jon Stewart's show on Comedy Central, where they had interviewed a North Carolina Republican committeeman who made the most outrageous racist comments about why they passed their voting restriction law. And the court writing verdict, actually opinion, I mean, actually quoted the Jon Stewart show, which I thought was pretty funny.
Well, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, who's a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases, and he was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peaceably demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. And he has an article at the News and Observer, "Dawdling Congress Means Dangerous Delay in Zika Fight." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down to the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.